Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show,
the way we purchase things and the way we dispose of things. It can be the energy that we're using in our buildings.
Healthcare's climate impact tackled in new guide from Monash University.
So we really set the standard and other states followed. And of course, there were a lot of other changes to legislation in the subsequent 50 years.
South Australia celebrates 50-year milestone since homosexuality was decriminalised. And later today,
you tended to take on their bias or have decisions or make opinions in line with that bias.
Artificial intelligence may be altering your political views. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Australia's healthcare system is saving lives every day. However, it's also contributing to climate change, responsible for over 5% of the nation's emissions. Now, a new guide led by Monash University is aiming to change that. 16 major organisations, including hospitals, government departments, and healthcare experts, have joined forces to cut emissions, reduce waste, and deliver better care. I spoke with Professor Angie Bone, the key voice behind the guide from Monash University, about what this means for the future of healthcare.
There's many surprising ways that hospitals and clinics produce emissions. In fact, as you start getting into it, you realise that everything is associated with emissions. So that can be the way we purchase things and the way we dispose of things. It can be the energy that we're using in our buildings and our transport, but it can also be in the way that we deliver care. We know, for example, that about 20% of the emissions from a health system come from pharmaceuticals. Once you start getting into it, you realise that there are carbon emissions associated with everything that we do, and there are many things we can do to reduce those emissions.
You've said the healthcare sector is both treating patients and contributing to climate change. What has been the general response from healthcare workers around that contradiction?
We know that climate change is already causing health impacts. So if you think about the increased hospitalizations in emergency departments from smoke, from bushfires or from heat, you think about the mental health impacts of loss of homes or livelihood or being displaced, or some of these kind of new emerging infections like Japanese encephalitis virus. And our healthcare workers are on the front line, they're seeing this. But what we also know is that as they're caring for patients, they're also creating emissions which are contributing to the problem. And that's quite a difficult paradox for a sector that, you know, has a number of ethical principles, including the principle of first doing no harm.
The guide suggests actions like using clean energy and cutting waste. Which changes do you think will make the biggest difference?
There's quite a lot of research which shows that while we often think about the energy in buildings, about 80% of the emissions come from the way we deliver care. We also know that a certain proportion of care causes harm inadvertently or is what we call low value. For example, if tests are being duplicated because people don't have the information they need, or treatments are not of very much benefit to patients. So if we could reduce the less safe or lower value healthcare, we could really make a significant reduction in our emissions. It's estimated that about 40% of the emissions from healthcare come from this harmful or lower value care.
how can healthcare practices become more environmentally friendly moving forward?
There's many things that healthcare practices can do to become more environmentally friendly. Firstly, they can look at their energy supply and their energy efficiency, the way they use energy. They can look at how much transport is involved and whether they can switch to electric vehicles, for example. They can also look at what they're purchasing and to see if there are ways to reduce the footprint, either by the items themselves or, for example, the packaging or the transport involved, and the amount of waste that's created. There are many consumables and medical devices that are used that could be either a lower carbon option or aren't necessary. And then the last thing that healthcare facilities and healthcare professionals can do is to look at how much more care can be delivered in the kind of prevention, early intervention space, in primary care, general practitioners, community care, rather than waiting until people get ill and then treating them in hospitals where they, you know, need treatment, but trying to avoid some of that need for treatment in hospitals, which are high cost and high emissions. Importantly, the actions to increase environmental sustainability have wider benefits for patients and the system. They're designed to be reducing hospital demand by preventing disease and strengthening primary care, and reducing waste in all its forms. So the material waste, but also the waste that occurs through inefficiencies, the waste of time, the waste of energy, the waste of goodwill. And so what we want people to do across the health sector is read the guide and use it to inspire, motivate, and challenge themselves to provide better care at a lower cost to the system and also to the environment.
That was Professor Angie from Monash University speaking to The Wire. Early this month, South Australia celebrated 50 years since the state became the first to decriminalise homosexuality in the nation. Commemorative and community events were held, including a reenactment of parliamentary debates that changed history. The reform was described as progressive, both nationally and abroad, with the move setting a precedent for other states who followed in the two decades after. Many in the LGBTIQA plus community have reflected on that moment as a historical turning point. The Wire's Emma Watsky has the story.
I well remember my boss coming to my office the next day when it was in the press and it had been announced, and he said, "Will, welcome to the human race."
That's Adelaide's self-described, unreconstructed gay liberationist and queer activist, Will Sergeant, OAM. It was October 1975. He recounts the country's landmark moment as SA adopted reforms. But it wasn't always like this for Mr. Sergeant, who recalls his own personal conflicts in the years prior.
Although I was a very flamboyant young man, I really repressed and denied my homosexual desires. And in fact, at the beginning of 1972, I'd left full-time study and got a job in an accountant's office, primarily to earn money to pay for aversion therapy, electroconvulsive therapy, to be cured of my homosexual desires.
1972, homosexuality was illegal in Australia, bringing with it a stigma of shame, a criminal conviction, and the risk of up to 10 years behind bars. That same year, Dr. George Duncan, a law professor and gay man, was pushed into Adelaide's River Torrens, where he fatally drowned. The event triggered a significant push for gay rights and the liberation movement.
And a couple of months later, at the launch of Dennis Altman's book, Homosexual Oppression and Liberation, Gay Liberation Front was formed. And my sister brought me home a leaflet. She was a student. Shortly afterwards, I attended my first gay liberation meeting, which was just groundbreaking for me. It was my salvation, meeting other young, radical, gay women and men who were out and proud.
In the following years, Adelaide saw its first Pride March, a symbol of rising power amongst the community. Photos of the time portray people streaming streets of the CBD, carrying messages of rebellion and and hope. That campaigning echoed into the chambers of state parliament. It took three attempts, with initial foundational efforts by Liberal MP Murray Hill. But 50 years ago, backed by the John Dunstan government, reform was made. Labor MLC Ian Hunter was the first openly gay man elected to the South Australian Parliament, and he reflects on his teenage years as parliamentary debates took place.
Personally, I was 15 at the time, in 75. I'd known that I've been homosexual since I was about 10 or 11. Growing up and going to school each day where you get called a poofter and abused, you learn pretty quickly that what you are is not to be talked about, certainly not with the family, certainly not with people at school, and you had to remain hidden. When it went through for me, it was a huge relief. I was questioning whether I had any future in the state at all, with the prospects of criminal conviction hanging over your head. And I thought, well, perhaps I do have a future after all. Of course, you know, I didn't come out the very next day.
Earlier this month, advocates and parliamentarians convened for a reenactment of those speeches. Mr. Hunter says the anniversary event brought a mix of generations and reactions.
We actually had Honourable Peter Duncan speaking. He was the person who moved the private member's bill in 75 that finally was successful. And the Honourable Anne Levy, who introduced the bill into the Legislative Council. It was quite remarkable. The number of people came up to me afterwards, young people in particular, who weren't alive obviously at the time, who told me how moving it was to actually hear, and how shocking it was to hear some of the things that people thought was okay to say in Parliament 50 years ago.
Advocates across the country reflect on how the stroke of a parliamentary pen paved the road for decriminalisation of homosexuality in Australia and repositioned the trajectory of gay rights in the decades following.
And I think the fact that South Australia was the first jurisdiction in Australia to decriminalise male homosexual acts. And the important thing about that legislation, it was very progressive, even in world terms.
Some people say that laws don't change people's views, but they do. They certainly do. Also, it made it easier to move a few years later to introduce the Equal Opportunities Act in South Australia, where we, for the first time, had sexuality as a grounds for discrimination in the Act. Our legislation, of course, was very significant. It was the first decriminalisation in Australia, but also on a world basis, it was the first to actually treat heterosexuals and homosexuals on the same basis. It had a equal age of consent, and laws that apply to, for example, public obscenity apply to anybody. So we really set the standard, and other states followed. And of course, there were a lot of other changes to legislation in the subsequent 50 years in terms of surrogacy, the criminal code, the gay panic defence has been removed, and gay conversion therapy has been banned in most states now.
While reform has come a long way, LGBTIQA plus advocates say more is needed to support the community.
Going back 50 years, it was very much about sexual identity. So that movement has become much more important, gender identity, and the whole trans movement, recognising trans people and people's right to transition, for human beings to accept that diversity. You know, we're just not a strict binary. I think that's been a significant move to incorporate intersex people and trans people into our rainbow umbrella and queer family. And I think there's probably still a lot of prejudice against trans people, and there's certainly work to be done there.
Growing up and coming out is still a bit of an issue. It's a lot easier today, of course, and for young people in particular, we need to be very supportive of them through the process of coming out.
In terms of social change, how would you like to see potentially the political landscape expand to further inclusion?
I think there is still some more work to do around the country in terms of parliament. And I reflect on what the federal government's looking at in terms of a Human Rights Act. I've chaired a committee recently that also looked into a Human Rights Act for South Australia. We've got a lot of rights bit over various bits of legislation in our state, at least. My committee decided that it would be a good idea to bring it all together in one human rights bill.
The Wire's Emma Watsky ending the story. You're listening to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM and to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3 and to the other side of the country to Radio Goolaree in Broome, Western Australia. Artificial intelligence may not be new, but the fast-paced growth of AI is finding more and more uses in daily life, even to help voters form an opinion. Now many are growing worried about its growing impact on political discourse. The Wire's contributor from The Source News, Nahal Naraji, investigated more.
Artificial intelligence, the technology that has taken the world by storm. It's everywhere, from our social media apps to our text messages, even in our TV ads. But it's now also becoming a key player in a bigger part of our world, our politics. The burst of AI systems, also known as large language models or LLMs, has seen a spike in chatbots being used to help users make important political decisions. PhD student at the University of Washington, Gillian Fisher, says more and more voters are turning to these systems to get help and answers on political opinions.
People are starting to use these large language models like Google a lot of the times. You hear something, or maybe there's a news event that's going on and you want to learn more about. And instead of going to Google, people are starting to go to ChatGPT and saying, what is this word I heard in the news, or what is this event that happened?
So what happens when these chatbots have a hidden political bias? Well, according to Ms. Fisher, many users' opinions become heavily influenced by the information they're given, even if they aren't always objective facts.
When you interacted with the politically biased models, you tended to take on their bias or have decisions or make opinions in line with that bias.
But it doesn't stop there. AI is also being used to create deceptively real-looking deepfake content to spread misinformation and sway public opinion. This content can look like seemingly real video and audio clips, or even social media posts from accounts that appear to be normal. Spokesperson for the Australian Electoral Commission, Alex Morris, says this type of AI content has become a growing issue in political discourse around the world.
One thing that we've seen, not just in Australia, thankfully, but more often around the world, is the use of AI-driven, chatbot-driven, inauthentic social media behaviour to attempt to sway political debate in other countries. If that happens in Australia, how would we know?
Mr. Morris says while the issue of political misinformation is nothing new, the use of AI content has made it more widespread.
What is happening with this AI technology is it is available to a lot more people. It's a lot more accessible than it has been. It can be cheaper to access as well, which has sort of democratised access to this sort of tool.
With AI progressing so quickly, he says we are yet to see how this growing issue will impact future elections, but the AEC already has its sights set on some strategies for Australian voters.
Australia has 3-year electoral cycles. Our next election is due in 2028. Goodness knows what the technology is going to look like at that point. So we're already planning for the next federal election and thinking about how we'll be responding to what will be a societal issue that we'll all have to grapple with and how it will affect elections.
Until then, it's up to us to be careful about where and how we find our information for political decision making.
If you see something and you're not absolutely certain where it came from and absolutely certain that it's correct, stop yourself before you share it if you're not sure that, if you can't verify that it's accurate.
The spokesperson from the Australian Electoral Commission, Alex Morris, there speaking with The Source News, Nahal Naraji. Adelaide has welcomed its 2025 Film Festival, one of the most highly anticipated screen events in the state. The showcase is built on collaboration with strong emphasis on promoting both established and upcoming South Australian filmmakers on the stage as international players. As crisis continues to merge across the world, a new perspective more vital than ever. And how can film expand perception? The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with Matt Kesting, CEO and Artistic Director of AFF, about films offering a new direction for humanity.
In celebration of the opening gala for the Adelaide Film Festival, with such a strong representation of South Australian talent this year, how important is the AFF in cultivating and showcasing local filmmakers and actors on a national and global stage?
I think that the Adelaide Film Festival is a significant platform to showcase local talent And the way that we do that is by positioning it alongside of the very best of international cinema. So we're a very tightly curated program of films, and about half of the program is Australian and half is international. So we'll have films like the Palme d'Or winner alongside of a directorial debut from South Australia or from Australia. And I think that that positioning of a new Australian voice alongside of highly celebrated international cinema is a way of elevating our own stories and new voices in cinema.
If you could comment a bit further on that, how does the AFF contribute to the growth of the South Australian creative arts sector, particularly in relation to career prospects and opportunities for youth creators?
The Adelaide Film Festival contributes to the growth of the local sector by a number of means. And that's both as a means of financing their projects, but also connecting them with international programmers, and also as a benchmarking thing too, so they can collaborate with their peers internationally. For example, taking filmmakers to Cannes, I guess foremost through the AFF Investment Fund. We provide equity investment in new screen productions. Over the last 20 years, we've supported over 160 projects. So this year we're unveiling 10 new projects. Our opening night film, Jimper, directed by Adelaide's own Sophie Hyde, is one of those projects. So it is really the place to look for the next generation of filmmakers.
In terms of the nature of the program itself, this year's festival features films tackling urgent global challenges, particularly in the Change Award category that recognises films for their positive or environmental impact or offering a new direction for humanity. How do you see the AFF program shaping the way audiences think about issues like climate change or human rights?
Yeah, you've mentioned the AFF Change Award. AFF was the first festival in Australia to host such an award. I mean, we all know that the world is on fire. We're in a climate crisis right now. And I think film is the most immersive art form. And through being able to see the world through someone else's eyes in a very relatively short amount of time, you know, a feature length film might be 90 minutes, it can change people's perspective. This is why I'm so passionate about cinema as a vehicle to affect change and inform and challenge. So that award is really about giving prominence to the filmmakers that are at the coalface, grappling with those really urgent issues that are affecting humanity, whether they be more of a social nature or environmental.
For people who haven't yet experienced the Adelaide Film Festival, what makes this year's festival unique and what are some highlights we can expect to see on the big screen?
Our festival this year, we've got over 130 films, about 85 feature films. But this year we've got three tentpole galas, the opening night gala last night, of course, and on Friday night we're presenting Surratt and having a rave party after. So that film really stole the show in Cannes this year. It won the special jury prize there. And look, it seriously blew me away when I saw it. It's a French Spanish co-production set in Morocco in the rave scene there, an incredible story and cinematic vision. And then, of course, closing the festival with Warwick Thornton's Wolfram. Within that, there are the competition is particularly strong this year. And, you know, if people have not been to a festival before, that's a really great shortlist of films to start with. Like, so there are 10 films in the main competition, five documentaries, five fiction films. But then there are bigger films too. You know, we've got the latest film from Yorgos Lanthimos. People would know him from Poor Things and his latest offering, which is Begonia. Yeah, there's lots of offerings in this year's festival, and you know, we think it's a pretty special edition.
Matt Kesting, CEO of Artistic Director of the AFF, speaking with the Wise Tia Bailey. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.